Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Good evening and welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm with Dr. Howard Rina, one of the new breed of brain surgeons that specializes in maintaining blood flow to your brain. Your brain is the computer of your body. The computer can't work without electricity. The brain can't work without blood. Stay tuned for Dr. Rina and how you can preserve brain function. Welcome to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm delighted to be with Dr. Howard Rina. Dr. Rina is one of a new breed of cerebrovascular neurosurgeons. He is an associate professor in the Department of Neurological Surgery at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical College. Howard, it's a distinct pleasure to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Phil.
Those are some big words that I used describing you as a cerebrovascular neurosurgeon. Can you put those in terms that we all can understand? What do you do?
Well, I'm essentially a plumber that works in the brain. The cerebrovasculature is the blood vessels that supply the nutrients to the tissue of the brain. And as you know, the brain is responsible for, it's really the computer that controls our bodies. So I deal with problems that affect these blood vessels, opening up blockages, fixing weakened parts of the blood vessels. So I'm sort of this plumber that fixes blood vessels in the brain.
Is this a real problem in the public? I mean, is it something a lot of people need to be worried about?
Well, certainly if you look at something like stroke, stroke is often caused when a blood vessel in the brain is blocked, and a problem like stroke is the third leading cause of death or disability in the country today.
And stroke sounds like a big term, I guess, kind of like heart attack and that. I presume there are different kinds of or different reasons for people having a stroke. Can you describe that to us?
Well, there can be. There are several different types of stroke. Anytime there is an event that affects the way the brain works, that in and of itself can be either a warning sign for stroke or a stroke itself. If a blood vessel in the brain gets blocked and the tissue on the other side of that blood vessel, the tissue that's normally to receive the blood, no longer receives the nutrients, that brain can die. And if that happens, it will stop to function, and there will be warning signs first, and then those deficits or lack of function can become permanent. So that's a specific type of stroke. Sometimes there can be a hemorrhage or a bleeding into the tissue of the brain. That's another type of stroke. And if a blood vessel itself pops or leaks blood through something like an aneurysm, which is a sort of like a blowout on a tire or a weak part on a blood vessel wall, that also is a type of stroke. So there are many different types of stroke. They can involve either the blockage of a blood vessel, which can be temporary or permanent, the leakage of blood from a blood vessel into this sort of the space around the brain, like in an aneurysm, or an actual hemorrhage into the brain itself.
And a hemorrhage is a bleed as well.
Sure.
Yeah. You mentioned warning signs. You know, that's what the patient's always wondering. Geez, am I having a stroke? What are those warning signs?
Well, fortunately for us, like you implied, if a blood vessel is being blocked for the largest type of devastating type of stroke, when that tissue stops receiving blood, there can be a symptom. That symptom could be as simple as a headache, or if the tissue that is involved controls the movement on one side of the body, say the movement of your arm or your leg, or it controls your ability to make or understand words, those functions will be affected. So you may have difficulty speaking. You may have difficulty moving an arm or holding an object. You may have difficulty walking. Those can be warning signs for a stroke. And of course, the grand, you know, warning sign, or a severe headache that occurs out of the blue that doesn't go away, that often people will describe as the worst headache of their life, and that could be either a blood vessel rupturing or a hemorrhage or bleeding into the brain itself.
So at that point, it's almost too late. I mean, it's happened. You know, the event has happened. Are there differences between the way Americans live their life and, you know, Europeans live their life? Is there something we as Americans do that increase or decrease our risk for these kinds of things to happen?
Well, there are a few factors that put us at risk for developing problems with our blood vessels. In general, there's a certain genetic component, or how you're born, what you inherit from your parents and that they inherited from their parents, comprises part of the risk that you walk around and carry with you for developing one of these problems. However, some of the other things that we do, particularly in the United States and in the Western countries, can affect the health of our blood vessels. It can be as simple as what we eat, but it also involves how active we are. If you engage in regular physical activity, that can raise your heart rate, sort of walking or jogging, things like that actually improve the general health of your blood vessels. It's good not only for your heart, but also for the blood vessels that go to your brain. If you eat a well-balanced, healthy diet that includes a variety of different food types, that also improves the general health of the blood vessels. If you eat a high-fat diet, that diet can result in the deposits or the laying down of material inside the blood vessel walls that can narrow them and lead to such problems as stroke.
Are there any other types of behavior that are bad? Smoking, drinking, all those kinds of things. Are those issues? Well, or can I have a little bit of fun out on the street?
Well, so that's right. I was going to say certainly all the fun things. But absolutely that cigarette smoking, without a doubt, overall is detrimental to the health of the blood vessels. It can cause the blood vessels to constrict and be narrower. It can accelerate this process of the vessels getting narrowed and unhealthy on the inside. So cigarette smoking as a rule, it's separate from the other problems that it causes, such as lung cancer, is overall a bad habit to either start or maintain because of your general health. The other types of things, of course, I'm not going to tell you that it's not good to have an occasional glass of wine or something like that, because there has been some evidence that moderate, consumption of wine will be good for your blood vessels. But to consume anything in excess would lead to a decline in the health of your blood vessels, particularly the ones in your neck and in your brain.
So I guess the message that you want to get out to the people is that, you know, the preventive things that we can do to avoid this bad thing happening are, you know, stop smoking, don't drink in excess, and have a healthy diet and get some exercise.
I think those are some very good and strong rules that if you do those, it certainly will decrease your risk. It may not eliminate all of your risk, but it certainly will go a long way to reducing your risk of these things happening. And then if they do happen, your likelihood of tolerating a bad type of event will be greater because your overall general health will be better.
What you were describing sounds a little bit like a disease that's going to affect mostly adults. Do you see this in kids? Do we as parents have to worry about it?
We do see it in kids, but it's much, much rarer. We can have problems with the blood vessels, such as giant aneurysms, but they're extremely rare. We can have stroke in children where there are problems with the blood vessels. But again, these are extremely rare events. But we do have ways of intervening with children. And the good news about children is the children tend to be much more resilient than adults, so that when you're an adult and something happens to you, it may take you a lot longer to bounce back. The children, or in general, tend to do better.
So of all these different kinds of strokes that you've been describing, between plugged vessels and bleeding into the brain from various sources, which is the most common?
Well, certainly the blocking of a blood vessel in the brain would be the most common. When I alluded to before that this was the third leading cause of death and disability in the United States, that type of stroke, what we would call occlusive disease, is relatively prevalent. And that's where we've tried to make our biggest impact. First of all, as we were just talking about, the change in lifestyle can decrease the risk of such events. But that's where our big breakthroughs now in treatment have occurred in dealing with these types of individuals.
When you're talking about prevalence or, you know, how common it is, I mean, can you give us a general idea of, like, how many strokes are there a year in the United States?
Well, the last estimates have it at somewhere around 750,000 strokes in North America each year. So it's a huge problem. And if you translate that into the lost revenue and the costs of disability and cost to society, it's in the billions of dollars.
So you said the most common type is this plugged-up blood vessel. What does that mean? I mean, are we talking about any specific blood vessel? What happens?
Well, the most common scenario is that there's a blood vessel in the neck called the carotid artery. And the carotid artery will split into two blood vessels in the neck, one that goes to the face and one that goes further on into the brain and supplies the brain with blood. That splitting is called the bifurcation. And at the carotid bifurcation, or splitting, that's a frequent area for what we call the development of atherosclerosis, or narrowing of the blood vessel. What happens is, as this blood vessel starts to narrow over time, related to our diet, lack of exercise, and the like, sometimes small pieces of this debris can break off and go downstream. Now, fortunately for the way we're designed, when that happens, many times that little bit of debris that goes downstream will be dissolved. Sometimes it will go down and lodge in a blood vessel, and you will have a warning sign, so that you will have trouble speaking, you may have trouble moving an arm or a leg, you may have trouble seeing. You'll have some type of symptom, and then it goes away. That's referred to as a TIA, or a transient ischemic attack. But basically what that is that little blood vessel that gets blocked, that particle will get dissolved and open up, but you have this warning sign. Then we evaluate, or we take a look at that splitting of the blood vessel in the neck, and we look for this debris. If the debris is significant enough, then we can go in and open that.
So, you know, I think most Americans are a little bit of a gambler. Is there anything I can do to control? You were talking about how sometimes this debris, the schmutz, can fly up into somebody's brain. Can I select where it's going to fly, or is that just is it a crapshoot?
Well, you personally can't select where it's going to fly. It'll go where it wants to go. It'll follow the pattern of flow, and that's sort of predetermined on how you're built. But if you get one of these warning signs, you need to seek medical attention immediately.
Is it always a warning sign, or can it go to having a real bad problem?
It can go to a real bad problem very quickly. Sometimes if those symptoms don't start to resolve in a very, very short period of time, you need to get to medical attention very quickly, because our window, or that period of time where we can intervene and force open that blood vessel, is very narrow.
So what is that? What is that window time?
Well, it depends on the type of therapy that we're going to do, but if you can get to an emergency room within 3 hours, that's usually when we can make an initial treatment to take a step to opening that blood vessel.
And is it always opening the blood vessel? Do we do that mechanically, or do we do that with medicine?
Well, we can do it both ways. If you get to the hospital within the first 3 hours, we try to do it initially with a medication. It's easier to get a patient, make sure that they don't have a big bleeding in the brain, and give them a medication to try to very rapidly open that up.
We're going to have to take a brief break from How to Save Your Life. Please stay with us as I speak more with Dr. Howard Rina on how to treat stroke and also to protect yourself from further injury after stroke. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and again, I have the pleasure of being with Dr. Howard Rina, professor of neurological surgery at Weill Medical College, Cornell University. Dr. Rina is one of the new breed of neurosurgeons that does endovascular therapy. He's a cerebral vascular neurosurgeon. He's been describing what he does, and before the break, we just started talking about the acute management of patients that present to the emergency room with a new stroke. Perhaps we could start back with what's the sequence of events that you go through when somebody shows up in the emergency room?
Well, when a patient shows up, the first thing that happens is they're stabilized. We make sure that their blood pressure and their heart rate are okay. And then a neurological examination is performed. And that examination allows us to determine what parts of the brain may be affected by this process of that we're calling stroke. The next thing we need to do is very quickly to ascertain whether or not there's a suggestion of a blockage. We do something where we do what's called a CAT scan. And a CAT scan is a fancy X-ray machine that takes a picture of the brain. And often we can see a bright spot where a blood vessel is blocked or filled with blood. The other thing that we can do is an MRI scan. And I think many people have heard about MRI, but basically what MRI stands for is magnetic resonance imaging. What that basically is that if we put somebody in a very, very strong magnetic field, the molecules that make up their tissues will all start spinning in the same direction. And when you turn off that high magnetic field or you turn off that magnet, the energy that's released when those spinning molecules go back to their sort of normal state can be interpreted by a computer and to give us a picture of the brain. And that can also direct us to where a blood vessel is blocked. The first thing that will happen then when we identify a blocked blood vessel, and we see that there's no evidence of bleeding in the brain, is give a medication called TPA. Now, what TPA stands for is tissue plasminogen activator. TPA is a natural occurring substance that your body produces, but not in the quantities that we would give. And this powerful clot busting medication can be given through an IV in the emergency room. And if it's given within this short window, it has a significant chance of opening up this blockage. If, however, it doesn't, then we need to take more aggressive measures. And that would begin by taking somebody up to what we call the angiography suite, which is a suite where we can look at the blood vessels in the brain. And what we do is we negotiate a tiny plastic tube up into the brain to the area where the blockage is occurring, and then try to give that same medication, that clot-busting medication, directly to the clot, hopefully to open that up. If that also doesn't work, then we can actually physically try to grab the clot and pull that out. And that's done with a device that we call the Mercy Clot Retriever.
This all sounds pretty high-tech and pretty new. I mean, how long has this stuff been around?
Well, the Mercy Retriever, or this mechanical clot-retrieving device, has really only been around about a year. And the clot-busting medications, which have been around for several years, are now being more routinely used in a variety of centers.
So is it safe to say that people don't have to worry quite as much about the devastating impact of stroke as they did 2 years ago?
Well, stroke remains a major, major health problem. And the problem that we have is, though, when we get patients, we may not get them within the hours that we need to open up these blood vessels. We can take many aggressive steps to get those blood vessels open, but if we're unsuccessful, then those patients will continue to have their stroke. If, on the other hand, we get the patient to medical treatment quickly enough, then our likelihood of a success is much greater. If we can get this mechanical corkscrew-like device, the Mercy Clot Retriever, into the clot or the blockage, we can often open up that blood vessel. And if that doesn't work, we still try again. We can try to inflate tiny balloons to open up that space, and sometimes we maybe even deliver a tiny metal cylinder or stent within the blood vessel to hold it open. Again, all to restore that flow of blood to the brain.
So the uninformed person says, geez, this sounds pretty invasive. Can you go into a little bit of detail? I mean, what is an angiogram? What does it really involve? Am I awake? Am I put to sleep?
well, we want you awake because we want to know how you're doing neurologically. We have an anesthesiologist there. We're monitoring all your heart rate and your bodily functions, but we need to be able to examine you. So you're sedated a little bit so that you hold still for the procedure and you're not feeling any pain, but we need to be able to examine you. And an angiogram begins by accessing the arterial system or the blood vessels. It's sort of the roadmap or the track that we have to take to get to the brain. And we usually do that by going into a blood vessel in the groin. And we put a tiny plastic tube into the blood, into an artery in the groin, and then negotiate.
Is that painful?
No, we numb it up so that you're not uncomfortable. And then we negotiate that pathway through the arterial system up into the aortic arch and then into the blood vessels that go to the brain. And
can I feel that tube running up my blood vessel?
Not at all. That's not painful at all. And then when we get into these blood vessels with this tiny plastic tube, we inject dye and take pictures, and that's how we can see this roadmap of the blood vessels and find which areas are affected.
So this gets back to your plumbing concept, huh? Kind of the Roto-Rooter?
Absolutely.
Yeah. You mentioned this thing called a stent. Is that similar to what they're talking about in the heart all the time? Are you using the same devices, or does the brain present any particular challenges?
Well, it's very similar in that it represents a metal cylinder that is used to hold open a blood vessel. The process of the narrowing of the blood vessels, which affects the blood vessels of the brain and the neck, obviously it's the same process that affects the narrowing of blood vessels in the heart. There are several differences, though, in the techniques that we need to be able to use to open up a blood vessel in the brain. The blood vessels in the brain have many twists and turns, and it's often difficult to negotiate or steer one of these stents around those turns. So the stents that we use in the brain are specifically designed to be soft so that we can get them where we need to be. It's a little bit different than that of the heart. Now, in the neck, where often a lot of the trouble arises, that's a straighter shot to get those blood vessels open, and we can use a stronger, stiffer stent to hold open that narrowed blood vessel.
You know, you talked about anesthesia earlier and other people involved. This isn't something you do alone. Is there a team, and are there centers that specialize in these kinds of things?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's been a lot of evidence that shows, first of all, that when you have many doctors that are used to dealing with these complex medical problems and they work together repeatedly over and over again treating these highly complex and sick patients, that these patients tend to do better. You have a higher success rate of opening up these blood vessels. In addition, there are centers for this type of work, such as Weill Cornell, where, again, patients are sent for this type of specific, technologically advanced type of intervention. So certainly the center and the team have a higher degree of getting these blood vessels open.
These kind of problems happen any time of the day, night, and you're on call for all this stuff. You have to be available, just like the firemen.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, majority of the strokes, for whatever reason, occur in the middle of the evening. You know, it's midnight, it's 1, it's 2, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, it's 5, 6, 7 p.m. at the end of the day. It can happen at any time, and we have to be ready to snap that team to work at the quickest notice, because time is very important to us.
Well, it's obvious from the tone of your voice and the passion and the descriptions that you give that are extremely articulate about this whole process that you love what you do. You're a bright guy. I mean, why not go into banking? Why not do something where you could do it from 9 to 5?
Well, I mean, I think just in relation to myself, I get a great satisfaction from helping patients that are like this, that are sick, where we can really change somebody's life. Someone could have a devastating stroke and never be the same, and their family would never be the same. And if we can impact that, even if we're successful a small number of times, we've helped many people in doing this. And so there's a great sense of satisfaction in being able to do that. It's not at no personal cost to my family, though, because my family doesn't get to see me for birthdays or holidays or dinners during the week because many times I'm working.
So how do they cope with that? You know, I mean, that Christmas Day or Thanksgiving Day, you're hauled out to do something like this. What do you do to make them happy?
Well, you try to make yourself available when you can for sporting events and to be there, you know, for parent-teacher conferences and to try to do the things that you need to do as a parent as well. But, you know, they get to understand that if when the beeper goes off and there's an emergency, that there's somebody that needs help on the other end, and that's a good thing.
Is there, in your family, dad, mom, granddad, bunch of medicine? Or
no, not at all. Actually, you know, my father actually started out as a butcher working at the A&P in Brooklyn. But there were no physicians in my family. It was something, as a child, I was always interested in science and doing things with my hands. And this sort of evolved into becoming a neurosurgeon and doing these types of things.
So there wasn't one moment where you woke up in the morning and said, ah, I'm going to be a doctor, number one, and then I'm going to be a neurosurgeon the next day?
Well, I mean, there is one story. I mean, when I was in seventh grade, I do remember that there was a girl in my class, because I was a boy at the time.
Who, you're not a boy anymore?
No, I guess I'm a man. But who said that she wanted to be a neurosurgeon, and we were competing a bit at that time. And I think that's the first or the earliest recollection I have of wanting to be a neurosurgeon. But for whatever reason, it stuck with me at that point, and I've continued to develop this, and it became my life.
We were talking a little bit about the impact of, you know, your profession and your life on your family. What have you noticed about the impact of stroke on, number one, the patient, but then also the patient's family? Are there higher divorce rates? Are there, you know, depressions?
A stroke is devastating, and you have to look at it from several perspectives. The first one being the patient. You're a highly functioning individual. Maybe you're a homemaker. Maybe you're an executive. Maybe you're a policeman, a fireman. And a devastating event occurs where you can no longer do this. The first thing that can happen is obviously, and a normal response would be depression. You question your own self-worth and your ability to provide for your family. And that's a normal process that occurs. But then the other things that happen, depending on the severity of the stroke, is you may not be able to care for yourself. And that burden may fall on your family members. Your wife or your husband may have to go back to work. Your children may have to stop going to school. It can have a dramatic effect on the family. And it's difficult.
I wouldn't want everybody listening to the show thinking that if I have a stroke, I'm going to be devastated. Are there a range of problems that a person can have?
Well, certainly there are degrees. There can be very, very minor events where, again, there can be a warning sign. We're able to intervene. We can reverse the process. And then with some modifications in lifestyle, increasing exercise, changing diet, adding some new medications, controlling high blood pressure, where a person can get back and actually be better off than they were beforehand. And so there are degrees. Not every stroke is a devastating stroke, which, you know, destroys a household and the like. But it needs to be taken as a serious warning sign, even though it may be completely reversible.
Earlier on in the conversation, you kind of referred to the brain as the computer. When I think of a computer, I think that, you know, if something goes wrong, I can put a new microchip in. How does that relate in terms of the brain? Can we do that? Is that down the road?
Well, we can't do it yet. It may be something that is available in the future, some type of repair to the brain. But right now, in 2006 and almost 2007, when there are areas that are damaged in the brain, unless other surrounding areas of the brain can pick up some of that workload, sometimes we can't repair that. In fact, the majority of the time, we can't repair that.
So it's not like the, you know, the lost arm or the lost leg where we can put a prosthesis on and the patient can resume almost normal life.
We don't have any prosthesis for the brain. Yeah. There's active research in trying to understand the brain and to get generation or regeneration of neurons that you know, are the cells that make up the computer. But we're just not at that point yet where we can repair damaged areas of the brain.
So, you know, you do your acute stuff and you save the patient's life and they go to a rehab hospital, I guess, after this. And what kinds of things can the patient expect or the patient's family expect to encounter in that setting?
Well, the rehab hospital is actually a wonderful thing that exists now where, or facility that exists now where a patient has an event and they may have a deficit or a loss of function. And they may not be able to do some of the things they used to do in the past. What happens in rehab is sort of a retraining. You may have to teach somebody how to walk again. You may have to teach somebody how to feed and care for themselves. You may have to teach them how to interact with their family just on how to get in and out of a car or sit down at a table. All these things are done in a rehab setting. It's getting that person back moving and being productive in society.
Are all rehab centers the same?
Of course not. Again, with stroke, it's brain rehab, which is very, very different because there, again, we talked about some of those issues of depression. There can be a loss in cognitive or the thinking function of the brain. So that a specially designed brain rehab center understands the subtleties that go along with stroke, and they are cognizant or they're aware of what they need to do and how they need to get people back home.
Aside from having the stroke, you know, your computer is hurt. As a result of that, are there other problems that the family and the patient are going to have to deal with, i.e. other medical kinds of problems that you typically see in these stroke patients?
Well, I mean, any patient that has stroke, we have to identify, again, the source of the stroke. But in that process, their general health has to be examined. Many patients that have stroke have high blood pressure, and high blood pressure can lead to additional strokes. It can lead to a general damaging of the health of the blood vessels. So if we treat that high blood pressure by a medical doctor, that goes a long way in preventing further events and improving the general health of the individual.
You know, one of the common questions I always get is, you know, can I have sex after having had a stroke? Are there any implications in terms of, well, number one, the medicines that they get given for their blood pressure, and can they lead a normal sexual life?
It's a frequently asked question, and certainly we want people to be able to have sex because it's a normal human function. And many of the medications that we use, particularly in the treatment of high blood pressure, can impact your ability to have sex. And so that often we may need to get the urologist involved or make some modifications in the medication so that people are able to have normal, healthy relationships.
And do many of these people require seeing a psychiatrist?
Well, if there are these issues of depression, depression can translate into stress on a marriage or stress between a parent and a child, not necessarily the person having the stroke. There are tremendous forces that are now put to bear on a family or any type of relationship. And often a psychiatrist can help people cope with these new pressures that are being put on them. I think there's a negative stigma that's put on seeing a psychiatrist, but really there's great value in understanding that these are, you know, life-changing types of forces and that anything that you can do to buttress yourself up or support yourself during these difficult times is perfectly acceptable.
We have to take another brief break. Please stay with How to Save Your Life and Dr. Howard Rina. We'll be right back. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. This is Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm with Dr. Howard Rina, Professor of Neurological Surgery at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Before we left, we were talking about the impact of stroke on both the patient and their family. I wanted to flip back now to, again, the different types of treatments. We hear about medicines, which are obviously very attractive since there's no invasion of our body. And then you talked about angiography, or the sticking of rubber tubes in people's blood vessels. How do you decide, you know, which decision to make? I mean, which treatment do you use?
Well, it depends on the setting. If someone's coming in with an acute stroke, the first thing that we do is we want to find out where the blockage is, and we go through the CAT scanning and the MRI imaging to have an idea of where the stroke is. Then the most important thing we need to do is, first of all, determine how long from the onset of their symptoms did it take for them to get from where they were to medical attention. Because if they are many hours out from their onset of symptoms, and we give these very, very strong clot-busting medications, either in the IV or in the angiography room, we can actually cause a hemorrhage. We can have someone bleed into their brain, which could theoretically take their life. So that we have to be very, very sure that we're in this window of time period. There's a period that the tissue can be deprived of its blood supply, and that's what we call ischemia, where the tissue can be ischemic, but that's reversible. At some point, however, the tissue actually starts to die. And when the tissue dies and we start to reperfuse or reallow that return of blood flow, then there can be bleeding into the brain. So we need to know right away how long those symptoms have occurred. If they already have had a hemorrhage, that limits our ability to go in and give these clot-busting medications and return flow. And that would be a contraindication or a reason for us not to be aggressive. So we do these initial tests to evaluate these individuals, and then the first line of treatment, if they, you know, fit all of these criteria to be treated, is we try to give the medication in the arm and see if it starts to work. If it doesn't work, then we have a very, very low threshold to get them up into our angio suite and be more aggressive in opening and restoring blood flow.
Earlier we were talking about technology. Are there any newer technologies that you see coming down the pike that we should be looking for?
Well, the newest technique that we have now, and that was recently FDA approved, was the mechanical clot retriever, or the so-called Mercy device. And that, it kind of looks like a corkscrew from to pull out a wine cork, but it's very soft. And the idea is you deliver this corkscrew beyond or into the clot and try to pull it out. That's the newest thing that's available. But other people, and myself included, if the corkscrew type of technique doesn't work, we want to get that blood flow restored, and we can try to do that by inflating a balloon, and that balloon can open a conduit or a path for the blood to travel through. And then if we get a conduit open, we can use a newer type of stent, a stent that has enough force in the wall, something we call radial force, to actually hold open a blood vessel inside the brain. And that's where the newest technology is going to be, is trying to use a stent or a tiny expandable metal tube to open up these vessels if we can't pull out the blockage. So to create a new hole for the blood to pass through and then widen that hole with this metallic stent. And then further down the road, we may have newer medications that may either dissolve the clot or protect the brain at least, so that we have a longer period of time for us to continue working.
What's the importance of technology to the advancement of this field? I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, it seems like you pretty much understand what's going on.
It's a 10. It's a 10 out of 10. We need technology to help us do what we need to do, and that involves our imaging or our ability to find out where a problem is quickly and rapidly. It includes our ability to restore blood flow, so dissolving the medications or mechanically pulling out the clot or with a stent opening them up. These are all technology-based concepts. And possibly in the future, it would be great if you could be identified, the ambulance comes to your house, and they give you an injection in your thigh, and that protected your brain. It sort of put you in a little state that you could be then taken anywhere where we could, you know, have the time and the luxury of restoring the blood flow.
So that, to me, means that there must be industry involvement in the advancement of this field. Is it prevalent in this area?
It's extremely prevalent. Industry, since they are in many times the people that are bringing new technology to the clinical setting, are very, very much involved. And so that there's often a collaborative relationship between industry and the centers where this is done, including the physicians that are doing this type of work, more so than other areas of medicine.
Yeah, to a certain degree, it sounds like industry has gotten a bad rap in the newspapers. When you open the Post, it's always some pharmaceutical company or some other company being hit for some apparent impropriety. What's your sense? I mean, is this stuff easy and cheap to develop, or is it really incredibly expensive?
Well, I'm not a spokesman for industry, but I can say, though, that these things are quite expensive, and the development alone can cost hundreds of millions of dollars to develop a device. And then before a device can be used in a human being, it needs to be tested in a variety of ways and in a variety of models to make sure that it's safe. And these things are incredibly costly. And so before a device is at the point where it can be used on a human being, the investment by industry can be in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
In terms of the time frame that this stuff can be advanced, I've got an idea for a new stent today. When might I anticipate that it would actually be on market?
Well, my initial response to you would be, well, it could be several years. But there are ways that devices or new ideas can reach the clinical setting more quickly. The first part is that something has to be made, a prototype, and then that prototype needs to be tested, and then it may be ready for a clinical trial. And the Food and Drug Administration is open to allowing not necessarily a brand new device without any type of testing being used, but something that has shown significant promise and in some limited clinical trials shown some significant benefit, they'll allow studies to be done in conjunction with the local, what we call institutional review board, where groups of physicians at each institution can review something and decide to do an experimental device exemption or a study on a device that the Food and Drug Administration understands is an experimental device, but where its benefit may be quite great.
You were referring a little bit earlier to the clinical trials. Can you explain that a little bit? I mean, is that experimentation on my body? Is it easy to acquire patients to enter these trials?
It's not experimentation on your body, but sometimes, you know, when a new technology is introduced, there are often two camps. There's the one camp or one school that says, well, this new technology is going to change everything. And then there's often a more conservative camp as well, saying that this really isn't going to make much of a difference. And when you're dealing with incredible cost pressures now in healthcare, we want to know if something really is going to be of benefit. Now, if a device has shown some signs that it is going to help people, then it may be time for a clinical trial to truly look at whether or not it's going to do what its inventors or industry says it's going to do before that cost is turned over to the patient and society. And so trials are basically an investigation that's often sponsored with the Food and Drug Administration and industry and the medical center to investigate whether or not a device is going to be of benefit. It's not experimentation. We know that often that the device is safe to use, but again, a patient and the family needs to be aware that we're using it in an investigational type of manner, or we're trying to understand it better.
You've been involved in a number of clinical trials. Do you find that it's easy to get patients to enroll into those, or do they typically lean towards the standard and traditional therapy?
Well, it can occur in several ways. If you take, for example, if we talk about the disease process we mentioned in the carotid artery before, there are several trials that are looking at placing a metal tube or stent to treat the narrowing of the carotid artery, comparing it to the traditional surgical treatment where an incision was made on the neck and the vessel was mechanically or physically cleaned out and then closed surgically, which has been extremely successful over the last few years in helping people with this process. The new technology with the placement of the stent has shown significant success rate in the treatment of this process, but the question now is one superior to the other? I find that in my practice, you have two groups of patients. You have patients that will come in and say, well, surgery has worked in the past. That's good enough for me. I like the idea of having the diseased tissue out of there, and I want surgery. Or you have people that come in and say, I want the stent. I don't want to have surgery. I don't want an incision on my neck. I don't want to take those risks. But there are risks with both procedures. The difficulty is getting somebody enrolled in a trial where they have to be randomized into one group or the other, meaning that they're told that they're going to be either receiving the stent or surgery for the benefit of understanding.
So they don't have a choice.
Right. Yeah. And that's where the true difficulty is. I think patients often, when you present things to them, have a clear idea of what they want to do one way or the other. It makes it more difficult.
I was sitting here listening to you talk about all these various treatment plans that you can have for a patient and thinking about a sports metaphor. You know, the quarterback comes into a game and he's got to have a game plan. How do you prepare for each individual case? What do you go through?
Well, using your sports analogy, it's like having the playbook. You have the playbook in your head, and so the quarterback comes in and he looks at what situation he is, where he is on the field, and he has to say, well, I have to do this to get to this point, and what plays will allow me to do that. That's really what we need to do with this process. We get a certain amount of information from the imaging studies that we do, but when we do the angiogram, that's when the problem becomes apparent. That's where we see where the blockage is. That's where we see where the narrowing is, if it's in the blood vessel that splits in the neck, the carotid artery, or if it's further downstream in one of the blood vessels in the brain. And depending on where it is, what it is, that will determine which play we decide to use. And so you have to know the playbook. It's not completely random, but you also have to be able to act on your feet and make changes to be successful.
You know, in football, you misread the defense and you have a bad pass, and it's only a play. Have you ever had that experience where you started with a play, you go down a path, and all of a sudden you had to make a quick change or a drastic change in your whole treatment plan?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're trying to bust open one of these clots and you're using one of these medications and it's just not working, the next logical step might be to try to go and put our, clot retriever in there. But sometimes the clot retriever doesn't work either. And you have to be able to say, well, I'm going to use a balloon or have my balloon ready, or I'm going to use one of these new stents. You have to have your options open, and you have to be able to change at a moment's notice because, again, we're trying to revascularize. This is not simple work, and there's great risk associated with it, but we take these risks because the consequences of a devastating stroke are so great.
On a day-in and a day-out basis, you're dealing with with patients and the patients' families, and as you said, this is an incredible risk. What do you think the patients' families' response is? I mean, do you find that they're leery, or are they understanding, and it's, all right, you're the coach, go for it?
Most families, when something like this is occurring to a family member, want everything done. They cherish their loved one. They want to take every opportunity they have, even if there's a small chance of success and there's great, great risk. Most families want to say, well, if there's even the slightest hope that you're going to be able to do something and, help my loved one, they want you to do it. I think families understand, and you can explain things in such a way that they understand what you're going to do. And as long as you're clear to them that, look, anything that we do as physicians has risk associated with it. We can't do it without risk.
What's your greatest fear when you're treating these things?
That I won't be able to help.
And what's the greatest satisfaction that you get out of this?
Well, the greatest satisfaction is a patient comes onto the table and they can't understand the language. They can't move one side of the body. And I've seen this, and you actually restore blood flow, and they're talking by the end of the case within a few minutes and starting to move that side that was paralyzed. There's a great sense of satisfaction that you've altered this person's life forever.
15 years ago when you were doing this, did that happen as commonly as it's happening today?
No, it happens much more now. Our technology is better. Our little plastic tubes are softer and can get further out into the brain. And the tiny guide wires we use to get there and the stents are softer and able to make, you know, loops and turns. None of this stuff was there 15 years ago. So we're very, very lucky that we live in such an exciting time where, again, technology is getting better. Every few months we're seeing new ways of improving what we do. And so it's a wonderful time to be available to help people.
So when people use the expression, "this ain't brain surgery," how does that make you feel?
Well, I'd like to think that I'm a regular guy, but you know, it's like anything else. To be good at neurosurgery, you have to spend the time. You have to learn the neurosurgery, and to help your patients. There's another component to that, and that's being a good and considerate physician. So when you put it all together, you have to synergize that complex neurological field and these techniques that we use with being a good humanitarian, and I think that's the way we're able to do the best by our patients. It is a complex field, but you can't remove the human element from it.
I've had the distinct pleasure of talking with Dr. Howard Rina, one of a new breed of cerebrovascular neurosurgeons, a surgeon who deals with blood vessel disease in your brain. I hope that you've found this informative and hopeful in terms of your battle against stroke. Dr. Rina, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Ken Ipp is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Shartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.